From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, the historian Greg Prince is back with us. He's been working on a book that traces half a century of the LDS Church's policies and attitudes toward the LGBTQ community. Prince examines the church's battles against same-sex marriage, their efforts to cure homosexuality, the times they've softened, the times they've changed. And for all these actions, Prince says there have been consequences. We'll be right back.
KUER's community calendar is a resource where you can find hundreds of events happening across Utah. You can learn a new skill in workshops, experience art and performances offered across the state, scout family-friendly events and activities, and a whole lot more. You can also share your own events. Just fill out the form. It's all on our website, KUER.org. Just click Community Calendar under the Events tab.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. You sometimes hear religious leaders say church doctrine is fixed. It doesn't change. But of course, churches change all the time, and Mormonism is no exception. Take their position on gay rights and LGBTQ members. Just last month, the church rolled back a policy that deprived the children of same-sex couples from membership in the church, even though it was talked about as God's revealed will. They changed it. In his new book, the historian and active Latter-day Saint Greg Prince says the church has made a lot of important changes related to homosexuality over the years. Where they used to talk about gay relationships as filthy crimes, Prince says these days church leaders acknowledge there is some biological cause for homosexuality. But you see in Prince's book this ebb and flow in all of this, progress, but then withdrawal. And that's what he traces in the book, not just the history of the way church leaders are thinking about the issue, but their public activism on it. The book is called Gay Rights in the Mormon Church, Intended Actions, Unintended Consequences. Prince is an independent historian, and he's coming to Utah later this week. We'll give you details about that a little bit later on the program. He joined us from a studio in Washington, D.C. I guess I wanted to begin personally for you, and this is something that you've talked about before. Your younger sister is a lesbian. How has that over time influenced the way you've been thinking about this issue? How much of a conflict did it represent from you as a Latter-day Saint yourself trying to reconcile all of these kinds of things? Like, how did that play out into the way you've been thinking about this broadly?
It never played into it. I was accepting of the fact from the earliest time that I knew it. For my parents, it was a bigger issue, although they eventually did work through it. To me, it was just I was accepting of her. I loved her as a sister, and I didn't see that there was anything about my religion that required me to show her anything other than acceptance and love.
But your religion saw her as having made a choice to do this, or at least it did for a time. Your religion didn't allow her to live an authentic life sexually. That didn't bother you?
That part did bother me. It bothered me a lot because she and her partner left the United States and lived in Japan for about 2 decades, primarily because of the non-acceptance by their own religious community. And eventually both of them resigned their church membership, and her wife, Patty, became a Unitarian minister. So that part, yeah, that bothered me, but it never bothered me in the sense of casting any aspersions on my sister. I was fine with her. Yeah. I've always been.
There was this conversation you had and this growing friendship that you developed with the writer Andrew Solomon that, as you talk about in the book, gave you a new appreciation, a new sense of nuance about this issue. Talk a little bit about that. What were you hearing from Andrew Solomon that made you start to think differently maybe about all of this?
That's true, the way that you've put it. I was starting to think differently, and it did become the genesis for the book eventually, but it took me a while to realize that. A little bit of context on that was that about a week after the November 2008 election, which elected Barack Obama, but also passed Proposition 8 in California. Mm-hmm. I got a call from Helen Whitney, a PBS producer, who the year prior had broadcast a marvelous four-hour documentary entitled The Mormons. She called and said that because of the Prop 8 election, Andrew, who was her closest friend, had called her and had just really ragged on her for having said anything nice about, quote, this evil church, end quote, that helped to pass Prop 8. So her request to me was, can you help me repair this relationship? I had never met Andrew. I didn't even know of him at that point. But she made an email introduction, and over the course of probably a year, we corresponded periodically by email and eventually got the temperature down enough that we could start to have a civilized conversation.
What was the conversation? What was the give and take? Give me a sense of how your thinking was evolving as you were interacting with Andrew Solomon.
I think he was rather surprised that I was listening to and accepting many of his comments about the church. I was not trying to do just a blanket offense of the church because by that point, even though I had not been involved in Prop 8, I live in Maryland, and this was a California issue, I could see that this wasn't something that I was supportive of. If I had been called upon by the church to make a monetary contribution to Prop 8, I would not have done so. And so his surprise at my acceptance of what he was saying, I think, led him to realize that at least there were a few Mormons out there who were reasonable about this issue, whereas in the immediate days after the election, I'm not sure if he felt there were any.
Yeah. And how did he make you think differently about it? I get how he reacted to you. How did you react to him and what he was saying?
The real turning point came when I put out an invitation to him, essentially saying, rather than being a problem to the church, could you help me be a solution for the church? And he said, well, what do you suggest? I asked that he write an essay for Dialogue. And he initially agreed, but he was in the middle of a book titled Far From the Tree, was behind his schedule on it, and was just swamped with work. So after many months of him not doing anything, I reached back to him and said, how about we do an interview? He said that would be great. So I went up to New York. We spent an afternoon together, did the interview. He helped to edit that. It was published, but it was that interaction during the interview where he really started to sensitize me at a deep level, not only to the hurt that the church had caused by Prop 8, but also to the joys that he and John, his husband, had experienced in a gay marriage. He said, we had not realized that this level of happiness was possible. And then he said, so I don't understand why the Mormon Church or any church would try to deprive us of that level of happiness. That was an entirely different way of looking at LGBT love than I had ever considered before. And that really was a permanent turning point in my thinking.
This idea of happiness, that was the turning point.
Yes. Of happiness and of having a committed, permanent familial relationship.
It's interesting to hear you say, Gregory, that when you were talking to Andrew, help me find a solution. Help me find a solution. What do you mean by that? And does that represent what you're trying to do with not just this book, but with the way you talk about this, trying to find a quote-unquote solution?
Yes, because what he was doing initially was yelling at the church. And I could understand that. It was deeply, deeply wounding, not just to the California LGBT community, but to the national community. And he was experiencing hurt on a very personal level. So I had hoped that he would be able to go in a direction that would be less hurtful for himself, but also that working together, we might sensitize the church to the complexity of this issue and perhaps even open up a discussion or at the least cause some rethinking whether or not there was that dialogue. And I think that that has been successful. It's still a work in progress,
yeah.
But there has been measurable change since 2008.
For sure. And we'll get to that. Remarkable change that came last month, of course. And we've talked to you about that. We'll talk to you about it again here later in the program. Is a book like this, where you express criticism of the LDS Church at points, urging them to rethink certain policies and attitudes, even rethink doctrines, is that the right way to go about this if you're trying to find a solution?
I felt that it was the right way for me to do it because this is what I'm capable of doing. Anything that I write is heavily based on data, and when I make recommendations, it tends to be on the basis of being pretty well informed by the data. I try not to get out in front of them. And so the criticisms, the recommendations that I make in the book, I think I'm fairly firm ground to make those, and we'll see what the effect of them is.
Yeah. One of the things, and we've talked about this before, is the part that Proposition 8 played in this larger story. One of the things you mention in the book is that the full role of the LDS Church in passing Prop 8 in 2008 hasn't really been chronicled, and that this was an important part of the book. We've talked about this a bit, but give us a sense of what you think is missing or has been missing in that story, in the telling of that story.
I think what has been missing is a fuller picture, not only of what the church did and accomplished in Prop 8, but how this was a continuation, really, of a game plan that began in the early 1990s in Hawaii,
yes,
and was repeated again in California in 2000 with Prop 22. So it wasn't just a one-off. This was a carefully thought-out strategy, and it overlapped other states as well, but Prop 8 in California was the most visible, and it's where the church poured most resources into.
Yeah. All right. Let me back up here, and I want to get to the 1980s, and this is something you write about. This brings into the conversation a Mormon church leader, part of the first presidency now, Dallin Oaks. Let's talk about Dallin Oaks and how important he seems to be to this story and how his views about homosexuality have influenced the church's position past and present. Now, one of the things you write about is 4 months after Oaks, who was a very well-regarded legal mind and jurist. He was on the Utah State Supreme Court. 4 months after he's called to the position of LDS apostle, you mention about how he wrote this memorandum that, as you put it in your book, still informs the church's actions on LGBT legislation. Talk about that.
Yes.
Memorandum. What is that?
I don't know what the genesis of it was, whether he was requested by higher authority to write this or whether he just felt compelled to do it because he was looking out over the landscape and could see that LGBT issues in general were going to become higher and higher profile, that there was undoubtedly going to be a clash between gay rights and the positions of the LDS Church. But whether he was asked to do it or did it on his own initiative, it's a multi-page document that really has remained almost essentially intact in terms of the church's policy and, you could even say, playbook towards gay rights. We haven't followed everything that was in that, but for the most part, that has been the church's playbook. He even foreshadowed not only the possibility of same-sex marriage, but I think the probability of it and what could be done by the church to try to avert that as the eventual outcome.
Let me tease out a couple of the talking points that you lay out here that were recommended by Oaks in that memorandum. One of them, and this is interesting, he wrote this: "We speak in defense of the family, which is the bulwark of society. That seems like a central tenet in terms of this, the way the LDS Church has been thinking over time about this. I mean, I'm guessing this is one of the bases maybe for this so-called proclamation of the family, that getting at this opposition to same-sex marriage is going to be grounded in this idea of the Mormon concept of the family, I suppose.
Yes, and the concept of the family is central to Mormonism. We're certainly not the only church that prizes families, but we put a lot of emphasis internally and externally on the family. I think there would be few, if any, Latter-day Saints who would argue about the importance of strong families. The argument would come at the level of how we define a family. The nuclear family idea, which was pretty much a construct of the 1950s, where in the post-war years, the father was the breadwinner, the mother was at home, not working outside of the home, and the children were all happy. That was an ideal that probably was not matched very often in reality, but nonetheless, it became the ideal. Over the ensuing years, we've seen that that doesn't represent very many families in the world, much less in the United States or even in Utah, that more and more you have women working out of the home, that more and more you have single-parent families, either through divorce or through having had children without ever getting married, multi-generational families where grandparents, because of a variety of issues, are taking care of grandchildren. So the whole idea of a single paradigm for family really vanished a long time ago, but church policy didn't really take that into account. If you look at the church's emphasis on family and allow family to define itself, then most of the conflict dissipates automatically, but that's not a transition we've been willing to make as an institution.
I should just mention some of the other talking points here because I think they're interesting. I'm not sure how much they hold up anymore. Oakes was writing about, he writes this, "The legal rights conferred on marriage partners are granted in consideration of the procreative purpose and effects of the marriage between a man and a woman." And then he writes also, "One generation of homosexual marriages would depopulate a nation." So does that hold much water anymore? Does that really work? Is the church still using that as a justification? I mean, I remember you hearing that from time to time as arguments in the past. But is that still around?
Well, it's an interesting argument that you can dismiss almost in the blink of an eye. You could say the same thing about Shakers. If they had taken over the world, then the population would have ceased to exist after one generation because they were celibate.
Yeah.
I don't think it merits any more discussion than that.
That's Gregory Prince. His new book is called Gay Rights and the Mormon Church, Intended Actions, Unintended Consequences. Prince is coming to Salt Lake City this week, tomorrow night at 6:30. He's speaking at Weller Book Works at Trolley Square. On Friday night, he's going to be at Benchmark Books. We have all the details on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER.
Hi, this is Benjamin Bombard, one of the producers of Radio West. A lot of people want to know, does Doug really read all those books? The answer, yeah, he does. No one really knows how, but we do know that he gets up very early. If you want to try keeping up with him, you can buy the book by clicking on the indie bookstores, Amazon, or Audible links at the bottom of the episode page. If you do, some of the proceeds go to support Radio West. So thanks for that, and thanks for listening. Here's the show.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we have with us the historian Greg Prince, who has been working on a book that traces half a century of the LDS Church's policies and attitudes toward the LGBTQ community. The book is called Gay Rights in the Mormon Church, Intended Actions, Unintended Consequences. He's coming to Utah later this week. We'll give you details about that a little bit later on the program. I want to get forward to 1993 because this is a really an important time in this story. You say the LDS Church really, as you put it, crossed the street. In other words, went all in on this issue in 1993 in Hawaii. Give us a sense of what happens.
Yes. Prior to 1993, the very little that the church talked about or had in its policy manuals was directed inwardly towards church members. In 1990, three gay couples in Hawaii filed a lawsuit in the state court. The reason they did it in the state court rather than the federal court system was that the Hawaii Constitution is very liberal in how it handles issues relating to sex. And so the plaintiffs felt that there was a better chance of getting a judgment in their favor in the state than in the federal court system. The case was dismissed on summary judgment at the level of the district court. Nobody was particularly surprised at that. The plaintiffs then appealed that decision, and that appeal went to the Hawaii Supreme Court. Much to most people's surprise, the Supreme Court said because of Hawaii's institution, this case has to be tried, and they remanded it to the district court with the stipulation that it be tried on the legal doctrine of strict scrutiny. It says if there is a class of people that is discriminated against by a law, that may still be legal, but the burden of proof is on the state rather than on the plaintiffs. You had a class of people, LGBT, who were being denied a basic right extended to heterosexual people, the right of marriage. And so the Supreme Court said to the district court, the burden of proof is on the state to show that it has and prove that it has a compelling reason to deny this basic right to this class of citizens who are discriminated against on the basis of their sexual orientation. Once that decision was handed down and the case was sent back to the district court, the alarm bells began to ring all over the country. That, in 1993, is when the LDS Church jumped in with both feet, fearing, as did many other people and other groups, that if the law were switched in Hawaii, if same-sex marriage became legal, that because of the full faith and credit clause of the U.S. Constitution that says basically that the laws of one state must be respected by other states unless the other states have existing laws to the contrary. The fear was that people then would go to Hawaii, be married, move back to their home states, and those states would then be required to recognize those marriages. That's why it was so alarming to so many groups, including the LDS Church. They feared that that would be the first domino to fall.
You mentioned how the church really honed its political skills in its fight against what was going on in Hawaii. And is this where they really laid out a kind of a playbook, a legal playbook, a political playbook for the way forward?
Oh, absolutely, they did. Yeah. Now, they didn't follow it exactly in subsequent campaigns. One thing that they learned from was don't write big checks from church headquarters.
Explain that. Was this Gordon B. Hinckley who was trying to—
Well, he was not the church president
at the time.
He was in the first presidency. To his credit, and it makes me wonder how history might have been different if he had lived even a few months longer— but he said consistently in inner discussions, we need to be involved in this issue, but we don't want to, my words, be the tip of the spear. We don't want to have too much of a public profile on this because he realized that there was a considerable potential for backlash on it, which in Prop 8 there was.
Yeah.
But in Hawaii, they took a very low profile. They worked through a political action group called Hawaii's Future Today, and it would have been difficult for the public to determine that the Mormon Church and the Catholic Church were the primary backers of that group. But two large checks, one for $400,000 and one for $200,000, were written from church headquarters to help finance that campaign. Later, they decided that that was counterproductive, and so when it got to the Prop 8 campaign, they took an entirely different tack, which was to encourage members to write contributions and to make those contributions to another political front rather than to the church.
Can I just ask you a little bit more about the role of Gordon and the gifts, really, of Gordon B. Hinckley in orchestrating part of the Mormon campaign against same-sex marriage? Could you talk a little bit about how it was different, managed differently, for example, from Thomas S. Monson, who, as you mentioned, he was president when really the Prop 8 campaign was playing out? You know, Hinckley manages, as you say in the book, to keep the church in the background. He creates these front organizations, but the church is more upfront later, and it, as you say, it does a lot of damage to the reputation of the LDS Church. How would Hinckley have handled that differently? Have you ever speculated on that?
Oh, yes. I think he would have handled it the same way that it was handled in Hawaii and in California 8 years prior to Prop 8. The difference between Prop 22 in California in 2000 and Prop 8, which was 8 years later, was that they had identical wording, but the first one was a change in state law. The second was an amendment to the state constitution. So in terms of the text that the voters were being asked to approve, it didn't differ even by a comma in those two campaigns. The difference was that the church managed to keep a much lower profile in 2000 in Prop 22, and it passed easily. It passed by something like 66% in favor. Now, 8 years later, not only did you now have a new church president, Thomas Monson, who was very new to the job, even though he'd been a counselor in the first presidency for decades, but you also had a shift in public opinion on marriage equality. In 2000 and earlier in Hawaii, there was a strong, even a supermajority, against marriage equality. That started to shift, I think in part in California, because once Prop 22 was given the status of law, people started to realize that there was a social injustice embedded in that law. So when it came up again for a vote in 2008, after Prop 22 had been struck down by the California Supreme Court as unconstitutional, there was a groundswell of support for marriage equality, and I don't think the church leaders were fully aware of the strength of that. It was still a neck-and-neck race, and the margin of victory in Prop 8 was pretty small. But I don't think that the church realized how much growing support there was for marriage equality, and as a result, they were not prepared for the backlash when Prop 8 won.
We've talked a few times, in fact, about this November 2015 policy, which labeled same-sex partners as apostates. It deprived their children of membership within the church. We've talked about that a lot on this program. And, of course, we have to update that now, and which we have, is the church has now basically reversed that policy. But you've explained what happened then in November of 2015 is pretty unprecedented in some ways, where leaders were asked to basically sustain a policy without a whole lot of discussion or debate, and how there were these, as you put it, cracks appearing in the institutional facade. What can you say now about, I guess, the divisions within the upper ranks of leadership that seem to have come through last month when the decision was reversed? It seems like there's a give and take going on. It's hard to probably do much more than speculate, but what can you say about the divisions in the Mormon hierarchy that are reflected in all of that?
I don't have any information about whether divisions that may have been in place in 2015 deepened, and whether the players on both sides of the dividing line had remained the same or whether some had shifted. I think that the catalyst for the change, my speculation here, was not necessarily deepening divisions, but probably a reaction to a reality in the church that was and should have been rather disturbing, even frightening. And that was that people in the aftermath of the 2015 policy began voting with their feet in large numbers, really large numbers, perhaps into the hundreds of thousands if you measure not just formally resigned memberships, but more importantly, people who just said, that's enough, and quietly walked away. My hunch is that that was the driving force behind this, but it certainly would have been reinforced by those who had been upset by the policy when it was instituted 3 years earlier.
So when it happened, how did you react? What was your general reaction, like in your first reaction when you heard that, as I said, early last month, leaders of the church announced they'd reversed that policy? It was basically a full rollback of that. What was your initial reaction?
My initial reaction was, this is amazing. I welcomed it, but I was caught totally off guard. For two reasons. One is that there has been an aversion since the founding of the church for people at the top to be accepting of change very often. There's the idea in any religious tradition that constancy is one of the cardinal virtues. And so any kind of change comes rarely and with great difficulty. The other factor, though, was that by the current church president, Russell Nelson, essentially canonizing the 2015 policy by 2 months later, saying this was a revelation to President Thomas Monson, it put the church in a particularly tight corner. How do you move from something that has been inscribed as revelation to an opposite policy? How do you do that? And I had talked to some church officials not long after the 2015 policy was announced. One of them said, we are painted into a tight enough corner, it may take us 15 years to get out of this. And yet it took 3 years. So I think that what it really speaks to is the strength of the data that were coming in to show that the church were voting with their feet in large numbers, and that was strong enough to counter a prior revelation, which in my mind, and I think on the historical record, is unprecedented within the LDS tradition.
It gets us to this conversation, and you go through this in some detail in the book, about the way the LDS Church thinks of the biology here, because you talk about how that the policies and attitudes of the church are shaped by certain things, this idea that it's a sin, this idea that there should be punishment connected to that sin, and the idea that it's a choice. One of the things that you have talked about is how the church deals with the biological paradigm, as you put it, of homosexuality, how they've talked about it, how they used to talk about it. They just basically said in no uncertain terms, it's a choice. Now they have to be a little bit more nuanced about it. But where have they come in their thinking about this as a biological reality, a person's sexual orientation?
It still is a work in progress. You don't have to go back many decades, both for the church and American society, to have embraced fully the behavioral paradigm that this is just a choice. Science really didn't begin to speak on this until the era of molecular biology, and then really several years into that era. Initially, there were expectations, hopes on the part of the biological paradigm that there would be a gay gene that would explain all. Dean Hamer, who was a researcher at the National Institutes of Health, was leading the hunt for that. And when he failed to find such a gene, and when others failed to find it, the behaviorists, I think, probably declared victory, although it turned out to be premature. It turns out that the biology of homosexuality is far more complex because homosexuality is not a monolith. Look at a medical entity, for instance, such as cystic fibrosis. We know exactly which gene is involved in that and which part of the gene can mutate to cause that. It's completely well-defined, a single gene. But most conditions and even most traits, normal traits, including sexual orientation and gender identity, are not single gene determinant. They may be multiple genes working together. And then far more complicating is what's called epigenetics, which means above genetics. It's the other factors that are influencing how those genes are expressed, both in utero and even later in life. And as that story has started to unfold, and as we are able both to identify more of the flavors, if you will, of sexual orientation and gender identity, and then start to develop known associations of those flavors with certain biological processes, the biological paradigm has gained more and more strength, and it will continue to do so. There are still going to be naysayers who will say it's just a bad choice, and I think some of those are even in high ranks of the LDS hierarchy, but I think that the certainty of their voice is not as strong as it used to be because the biology is speaking clearly more and more.
You call it homosexuality an indelible, unchangeable imprint. And there are a variety of causes. Some are genetic, some are epigenetic, none of which, though, you say is a conscious choice.
That's right.
Yeah. So you call biology the elephant in the room here in this question about the relationship between the way Mormons are thinking about this, Mormon leaders are thinking about this, and the realities. Let's talk a little bit about Mormon afterlife theology and what this means for all of this. Because you say the current policy about homosexuality, this is how you put it in your book, amounts to reverse engineering of the church's afterlife theology. Because I guess, in other words, you can't be gay and get into heaven. And so that requires in your theology this idea that homosexuality is just a temporary condition. So what are you hearing from leaders now and how they think about gay Latter-day Saints and where they may end up in the afterlife? How are Mormons thinking about that now?
There's not been a word that I have heard or read even about the whole idea of gay in an afterlife. The absence of that in what has been said and written is what leads me to say that our current policy is certainly consistent with a reverse engineering of that. If you have an afterlife theology that can't accommodate gay, then how do you accommodate it as a legitimate way of being in this life? And I think that's where they have been. The more that biology speaks on this, the more I think the door is open for a reevaluation of an afterlife theology. I have no idea what's out there, but I'm certainly open to there being more than a bipolar, meaning strictly heterosexual male, heterosexual female existence then.
You are quoting some general authorities, and these were expressions not so long ago that were made in some cases at particular gatherings. I'm not sure if they were at general conferences, but they were made in public. A general authority by the name of James Mason said in 2005 this quote, "In the day of resurrection, you will have normal affections and be attracted to the opposite sex." He was speaking to a group of gay Latter-day Saints. That, in other words, in the afterlife, you'll be fixed. Here's another one. This comes from Lance Wickman, another general authority, who said same gender attraction did not exist in the pre-Earth life. This is what Mormons believe, that there was a pre-Earth life, and neither will it exist in the next life. One more general authority. If you are faithful on resurrection morning and maybe even before then, you will rise with normal attractions for the opposite sex. So you're hearing all this rhetoric from general authorities saying, don't worry. If you have this same-sex attraction, it'll be cured. Are they still talking that way? Are they still thinking about it in those terms?
I'm not hearing that, and I would put two qualifiers on what you just said. One is that none has had the imprimatur of the first presidency, and all were two levels below that, members of the first quorum of 70.
So mid-level guys were just kind of winging it in some cases.
I think so, yeah. Right. Because that tone has not been carried by subsequent leaders. For the most part, they've just been silent on the issue. There was an interesting doctoral dissertation done a few years ago. John DeLynn did it at Utah State University. He did a large survey, about 1,600 LGS, LGBT persons. Just before he deployed his questionnaire, one of his committee members, Bill Bradshaw, professor of biology at BYU, said, John, I think there's a question that you should add to it. And the question was something along the lines of, have you ever had any spiritual manifestation that informed your sexuality? A fairly open-ended question.
Yeah.
My recollection in talking to Bill and also talking to John was that about 60% of the respondents indicated that they had some type of manifestation. So that would be 1,000 people. Of those, 800 said, the Spirit said to me that this is the way I am and will be. So on the one hand, you have quoted 70s who were pretty far out there on the one extreme saying this is the way it will be. On the other hand, you've got quite a few people in the hundreds saying, you know, that's not the impression that I've had in terms of a spiritual manifestation. How do you weigh those two in the balance?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, but I think it really calls for some open-mindedness.
Isn't that the nature of Mormonism, that people are imbued with this sense of personal revelation and therefore, yes, what they hear from leaders is important, but also they have to be accountable to their own sense of conscience about all of this? I'm not sure if that's entirely unique to Mormonism, but it seems important.
I would say that it's important to the point of being bedrock.
One of the things you write about in the book is what you call this counterintuitive trend of some people wanting to return to activity in the LDS Church, return to what they see as their spiritual home, and yet they're still, you know, openly gay. And it sort of gets to the point where it seems like you have to make this choice. Because if you think about what happened last month, where the church rolls back that polarizing policy from November of 2015, what it didn't say was it didn't change the Mormon doctrine of seeing sexual relations by gay people as sinful. The press release that announced all of this said it's still immoral. It's still a serious transgression. So it seems like if gay Latter-day Saints want to return to their spiritual home, they're going to have to make this choice. And this is interesting because you write in the book that coming back to a church that demands celibacy is enormously difficult. But this was interesting. You point out this study that found, and I hope I get this right, that the best possible outcomes for the psychosocial health of LGBTQ Mormons was that if they were both active in the church, but also openly gay, whether they were sexually active or not. What does that mean?
I think that's absolutely right. And the people that I have interacted with who seem to be at greatest peace with their religion, with their life, are those who fall into that category that you just mentioned. I spoke in Phoenix to a group called All Arizona. All is an acronym that stands for Arizona LDS LGBT. There were about 300 people in the room, most of whom were LGBT, and they were all trying to make it work, either trying to maintain their culture or, in a better world, trying to unite with their church formally and be there in the pews, not just silent, but participating and adding to the vitality of the faith community. We talk about two terms. One is a faith tradition and the other is a church. Hmm. Think about the church as being the physical embodiment of that faith tradition. I've talked to so many people who, even if they have been excluded formally from the church, still want to hold on to that faith tradition. And I see that becoming even, I think, a stronger thread in the fabric of Mormonism.
Do you think you're going to see more openly gay Latter-day Saints now returning to the pulpits after the church backed off of that November decision? I mean, it seems like that seemed to be where things were going. People felt comfortable enough being accepted by their lay, you know, ministers, their bishops, and inviting them to come, being part of their, you know, their ward social groups and things like that. Or do you think that that you're going to see more of that now sort of returning?
I think what you'll see is fewer departures as we move into the future. The problem when people either walk away from their faith tradition or are cast out of it is, even if you change the rules, you rarely get them back. So yeah, there has been hemorrhage, and not all of that can be recouped, but at least it is creating conditions that bode better for the future than for the past.
You write about this shift taking place. I'm wondering how I'm thinking about Jana Reese's writing about millennial Mormons and their attitudes about, you know, same-sex marriage and LGBTQ issues. It seems like it's inevitable that the church is going to have to react to all of these changes and that it eventually will change. It seems to be a theme in Mormonism, not thinking there is much change going on and change going on all the time.
Well, there is a phenomenon embodied in the millennial generation that really is new. They don't look upon religion as a duty. My generation and older generation did. You're going to go to church because this is what you do. It doesn't have to be interesting. It doesn't have to be entertaining. You're going to do it. The millennials look at it very much differently. And one of the key issues for them is, does my church get it right on LGBT issues? Whether I'm straight or gay, that is going to be essential if I am to remain affiliated with this institution. Now, this isn't just an LDS phenomenon.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm on the Board of Governors at Wesley Seminary in D.C., and we spent a lot of time talking about all of the Protestant and Roman Catholics. They're experiencing the same thing, even non-Christian religions. How do you retain millennials in organized religion? Everybody is trying to find the answer. Nobody has found it yet. But for the LDS, with this added layer that was put in place with that November 2015 policy, I think it really drove a dagger into the heart of so many of the millennials, and they said, that's it. I spoke a couple of weeks ago to an undergraduate student at BYU who said he has a friend working in the church office building, so there's my disclaimer. It's at least third-hand information for me, but nonetheless, I think it's at least worth introducing in the discussion. He said, for the generation, a generation ago that represents the age cohort of the current millennials, the activity rate was 60%, 60. He said current information that he got was that for the millennials, it's 19%.
Wow.
If that's true, that's just like a rock dropping. It's such a precipitous decline. Now, I know Jana's numbers don't reflect that, but those numbers are at least a year old, and this has probably been an accelerating process. Whether it's 19, whether it's 25, who knows what it is, but it's a very low number, and it should be alarming. And I'm afraid we're not going to get many of those people back, even if we get to a better place.
Let me ask you finally, we began this conversation, series of conversations, dialogue, friendship you had with Andrew Solomon. You give him in your book the last word. wanted you to say something about that finally. It comes from something that he wrote about, a line that comes from Lucretius about the sublime being the art of exchanging easier for more difficult pleasures. Say something about
that. Yes, and what he's talking about there is for him now to have a committed marriage with John, for them to have George as their son, a biological son, through a surrogate mother, is a much more difficult commitment than just living singlehood. But the rewards for it are so much greater than anticipated that it justifies all of the difficulty. And that was the message that he was trying to send to the Mormon Church. He could easily have come out in that interview with his guns blazing, but he chose not to. He did talk about how damaging the church's actions with Prop 8 had been, but then he held out an olive leaf in the hopes that the Mormon Church could eventually realize that what he and John were trying to achieve is a higher level of existence than not being in a committed marriage, and that this, in fact, if it's extended to families of whatever definition, builds a stronger society and a stronger religion than not having that type of more difficult pleasure.
Gregory Prince. His book is Gay Rights in the Mormon Church, Intended Actions, Unintended Consequences. Prince is giving two readings in Salt Lake City this week. Tomorrow night, he's going to be at Weller Bookworks. And on Friday night, he will be at Benchmark Books. You can get the details at radiowest.org. Radio West is a production of KUER News. Tim Slover directed the show. The program is produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Thank you.